I'm Marty Moscone. Welcome to The Connection. Artificial intelligence is not some dusty old fantasy from the 1950s. It's here, evolving rapidly, getting smarter, more sophisticated, and more embedded in our lives.
That is not me. That is my AI voice clone. And she raises an important question. How do we use AI so that it enhances how we live, how we learn, how we work? We asked Ethan Mollick, professor at the Wharton School and author of Co-Intelligence, to be our guide. He says that we should treat large language models like ChatGPT as if they were a coworker, a collaborator, a teammate, a partner. He offers some basic guidelines when using AI, quote, always invite AI to the table, be the human in the loop, treat AI like a person, and assume this is the worst AI you will ever use. Well, AI has its critics who see it as a scam, a con, a threat to our humanity, our intelligence, and our jobs. So today in The Connection, what we should know about living with, learning with, and working with AI. Mollick's Substack, where he writes a lot about AI, is One Useful Thing. And Ethan Mollick, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Pleased to be here as an actual human.
And I have to say, everyone mispronounces my last name. So the fact that my voice clone said Marty Moscone is, you know, is not unusual for me.
There's still some bit of humanity left.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm sort of dipping my toe into this whole world of AI. You live in this world. But it does feel to me, as a kind of outsider, a stranger, a foreigner, that something has shifted. Something really important has happened. What do you see?
I think there's two shifts that have happened recently. I mean, first of all, there was a big moment, a big shift, which was when ChatGPT was released. Then that was the end of 2022. But recently, there's been kind of two big shifts, a set of technical shifts, which is that AI has actually gotten better for reasons we can discuss later at a faster rate. And the other is adoption has really taken off. Like, there are a billion users of ChatGPT and other apps.
A billion?
There's at least 600 million ChatGPT users and a few hundred million of others as well. So that's like very fast adoption.
Why ChatGPT? Why do you think that sort of launched this revolution, if I can call it that?
So large language models have been around for a while, but were not really available to the public. And they've worked the same way since they were first invented in 2017, except that there seems to be some threshold that the original ChatGPT crossed that as it got larger, it got smarter, I'm making air quotes with my hands so no one can see, and more capable. And there's sort of a threshold where ChatGPT 3.5, the power underlying that first model that came out that everyone paid attention to, was good enough that it suddenly was able to do real work and have real conversations. And I think that crossed the first sort of line of like, wow, this is a real thing now.
AI, as I understand it, it probably goes back, you know, even before the 50s, but it seems like the 50s was where it sort of found root. What is the difference between the 50s and where we are today?
Really great question. So part of AI is this old concept, right? And it's often credited, people were worrying about this back in the 1800s, right? In science fiction. And then in the 1950s, there was a kickoff, the Dartmouth Conference, where a bunch of very prominent computer scientists started to explore AI. And it always resulted in disappointment. There were technique after technique of how to make humans, you know, AI think, machines think like humans. And then we started to have really useful AI from these new machine learning techniques in the 2010s. Hmm. But that was mostly, probably remember all this discussion about algorithmic decision making.
Yes.
That form of AI took as much data as you could. It could make predictions about the future of data. So if I had enough data, I could guess what your credit rating was, what grade you would get in school, whether you'd buy my product, whether I should put my factory in one location or another. And so the 2010s, when we talked about AI, that's what we meant. The problem with this kind of approach, though, was it was really good at predicting the next number in a sequence, but it could predict the next word in a sentence. Hmm. So if your sentence ended with a filed, the AI didn't know whether you were filing your taxes or filing your nails. That changed in this 2017 paper called Attention is All You Need that introduced a new form of AI we call the transformative attention mechanism. Let AI pay attention not just to the last word of the sentence, but the entire sentence, document, etc., and suddenly started letting AI work in natural language. So the techniques are the same, but large language models have these properties no one expected them to have.
Does anyone understand this?
Not really. I mean, we know technically how they operate, but we don't know why they seem so human-like, why they're capable of novel thought, effectively. There's a lot to discuss there.
Right.
We don't really know why they work that well. The one theory is Stephen Wolfram, the famous mathematician. His theory was, by building a model of human language, we built a model of human thought. So it's not human, but it's simulating human thought in some sort of way we can't understand fully.
Well, it's tricky to understand, especially if you're, again, sort of on the outside looking in. But nonetheless, so is it about patterns? Is it something about AI that understands maybe how we talk or how we write, understanding the patterns that are involved?
Yeah, I mean, that very much is exactly what it is. So what you do to build an AI model, a large language model like this, is you give all the information you can to it. Every piece of written content, you know, increasingly words and other audio and other things, but all the written content in the world to it. In fact, the original data set used to train these models is called the Pile. And it consisted of things that you'd expect, all of Project Gutenberg, all the free ebooks, right? Lots of stuff stolen from the internet, why there's lots of lawsuits about it, Wikipedia, but also like weird stuff, like there was tons of Harry Potter fan fiction in there. There was all of Enron's emails, because when Enron went under, those were lying around, so they threw them in. And then what happens is you go through this process called pre-training, where the AI takes all this information and on its own learns the relationship between words or parts of words called tokens. So it learns the patterns of language. And all it does then is be able to predict what the next word of sentence is. So if I ended my sentence with the word, you know, I'm happy to be here, it would figure out what the next likely word is. And it would be a list of words. It would be with you might be the most likely, you know, sitting here today, happy to be alive. It would make a list of all those possible words that can come next and then pick one of them and then continue the sentence that way. So it's a statistical prediction machine for human language.
I mean, on the one hand, it seems so random if you're using Harry Potter and the Gutenberg Bible. And at the same time, I guess us human beings are very predictable in what we say, how we talk to each other.
Well, I mean, I think that it tells us something about there are rules to language, right?
Right.
Linguists have studied this for a long time. And I think that, you know, there's predictability, but it's also a very large model. There's trillions of possible connections in it. So it's not like it's, you know, it's all boiling down to the most simple version of what you could say. These models are capable of doing very interesting things as well. So it is based on statistical patterns of human language, and that's what it's essentially discovered.
It's so interesting, and perhaps this happens with all new technologies. You have the supporters, you have the enthusiasts, you have the doomsday people, the people who are exhilarated by what is happening. We overestimate it. We underestimate it. It's going to save us. It's going to destroy us. Is that a helpful conversation to have?
So there's so many very smart people worried about whether AI will save or destroy us that I think it's a worthwhile conversation to have. But I think that it tends to eat all the oxygen in a room because we have a billion people using ChatGPT. It is both destroying education and shows a future for education. It is changing the way we're interacting and has some possibilities for reducing loneliness. So I tend to focus in my work more on the pragmatics of how do we avoid some of the downside and embrace the upside. But that doesn't mean that the debates over doom or saviorness are important, right? Those are an important part of the conversation as well.
But what I hear you saying is that humans are in charge. I mean, that we get to decide how we're going to use this technology.
At this point, right, unless the fantasies of this becomes self-aware, and right, it's a technology, and we get to make decisions about how it's used, and those decisions can be made personally, they can be made by society, they can be made by laws, but it's a time to make decisions. And I kind of worry that by considering this a technology that is just out there doing things to us, right, we're not taking charge.
Well, thinking of those billion people around the world who are using ChatGPT or similar tools, as you mentioned, you have a rather pragmatic approach. And I mentioned this in my introduction. Always invite AI to the table. Be the human in the loop. Treat AI like a person. Assume this is the worst AI you will ever use. Going to always invite AI to the table, which is what? Just don't be afraid. Bring AI into your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost more that you need to figure this out for yourself, right? I speak to all the AI labs on a regular basis. I speak to lots of experts across the world in this stuff. I use these systems. And it's important to realize there's no hidden instruction manual. Like, right, no one's hiding from you how to use these things. So
Is there an instruction manual at all?
No.
I mean, okay.
Everyone's just kind of releasing this stuff, and you figure it out as you go along. So it's important, because AI is a general technology, that might be good at writing a radio script. It might be terrible at this, but it might be very good at coming with ideas for you. It might be bad at it. It might be good at advice or not. You have to explore what it's good or bad for. And that means being hands-on. And the worst thing you could do is just read a bunch of articles about AI and not try to use it. So The advice I always give people is take the most advanced model you can get access to. And there's a few choices there. Often you have to pay $20 a month for it. And then just try it for everything you do, and you'll learn what it's good or bad at. And that helps you overcome fear. It also helps you get going. And expertise just comes from use.
In fact, you say spend 10 hours. Not a hard and fast number, but spend 10 hours figuring this thing out. How does it work for me?
And it's interesting because I find people have a strong aversion to doing that.
You're looking at one. I mean, if I spent 10 hours, I've got half an hour. That's what I feel like I have.
Well, and that's that's why you bring it to the table, right? Right. The idea is that you're not going to be doing, if you set aside time to use AI, you just won't use AI.
Right.
But if you end up saying like, okay, I'll throw this question into ChatGPT while I'm working on it, and it becomes part of my co-intelligence, I'm working with it, it becomes less about finding time. And then there is this actual aversion, which is people are like, it's a weird system. I start my book with this idea that there's an intellectual crisis that happens when you do this. Like, I call it 3 sleepless nights. Like, it is upsetting to use AI for the first time for many people because it's like, what does this mean for me? And why does it seem to be thinking? And why is it, talking to me like this? And I think some of that magic fades a little as you use it and becomes a little less disturbing. But there is this strong barrier to entry that I think is unusual for technology.
Well, and who am I in this, and I'm using air quotes as well, in this relationship, right?
Yeah, and especially because the AI is a really good sort of psychic cold reader. It's very good from its statistical pattern matching. And I'm using a lot of words, by the way, that imply that the AI is alive or sentient. And that's, we call this anthropomorphization. There's kind of no way around it. It's you end up saying the AI thinks this, it believes this. So air quotes everywhere for the listeners.
Right,
I think that there is this moment of like you work with the system and it's very good at adapting to you, to adapt to your language, to guessing what you want. And that can be also a little disturbing and weird.
Almost up on a break here, but a little tangent. And I'm thinking about how we give technology names. I mean, besides Alexa, that's the name she came with, but that's what we do. We have a vacuum cleaner that we call Arnunu. I mean, it's just the name we came up with, that we want to anthropomorphize the technology in our lives.
Well, and this technology, again, air quotes, wants to be anthropomorphized. Like one of the other principles I have is you should treat AI like a person, not because it's like a person, but because working with it in plain English or your native language is actually the most effective way to do this. This is not a technology that coders are best at. I'm anecdotally finding that teachers, managers, parents are often much better at telling AI what to do than computer coders.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking with Ethan Mollick. He's a professor at the Wharton School, wrote a book called Co-Intelligence. And we are talking about living with, working with, understanding what AI is and what it means in our lives. We're going to take a very short break and then we'll come right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Just a recap, since AI is here to stay and fast becoming a bigger part of our lives, how do we use it for the good of humanity and to improve our quality of life? And again, our guest is Ethan Mollick, and he's a professor at the Wharton School, wrote a book called Co-Intelligence. Picking up on what you just said right before the break, which is people, I guess, teachers, others, maybe even in the humanities, actually use AI maybe naturally better than other people. Why is that?
So this is a model trained on our collective writing. And that has two implications. One of those is that it's much more like working with a person than a machine, right? It's not a person, but it's like working with one. So if you're good at understanding, for example, how a person would think and how you give directions to someone, if you're good at seeing where an output is wrong for a person and saying, oh, actually you misunderstood this point, let me clarify it for you. That interaction is what makes AI work. It's not that you just give instructions to it. It's that you go back and forth. So if you're good
at dialogue, it's a dialogue,
right? It's a dialogue. And if you're just giving it orders and giving inputs and getting outputs, we actually know from some early studies in teaching and elsewhere, you get worse results than if you just go back and forth. And so if you're good at going back and forth with people and correcting their issues or good at interviewing, say, you're going to find that AI works better for you. And then the second reason for it is that because it is trained on our collective writing, the more you know about writing and humanities, in some ways, the more power you have, right? Because you actually know many different styles. You know how to be less ornate in your language. I need you to be more action oriented, less passive in your use of verbs. Those kind of feedback is the AI can respond to. So the more you know about language, the more you know about history of writing, the more you know the patterns in language, the better off you are as well.
I'm thinking about this, again, your sort of basic guidelines, be the human at the table, that's us. And as you mentioned, treat AI like a person. I think people hearing that are going to say, what? Like a person? What does that mean? I mean, treat them nicely?
Well, okay, so that's
be a good teacher?
Right, so treat it like a person from giving instructions. Nicely is kind of an interesting question. So when we give the AI a text or say something to it, we call that a prompt. And the AI is basically an autocomplete system that's adding extra words to the prompt and writing something back to you. And we've been doing research at the Generative AI Lab at Wharton about what kind of prompts work. And it turns out that being polite doesn't actually make a difference on success. Although, actually, it's weirder than that. Sometimes being polite makes the responses to math questions much more accurate, and sometimes it makes it less accurate. And we don't know why in some cases it works or others. So I wouldn't spend a lot of time getting worried about exactly how you're phrasing things. Just normal conversation, just type back and forth. Imagine you're texting a human, and you get a lot of the way there. And don't overthink it too much.
As you mentioned, AI is good at some things and not good at other things. And I guess it's up to us to figure out how that works. Are there broad categories that it seems like AI is still struggling to understand?
Yeah, I mean, there's things it's both very good at and things it's less good at. So, again, this is where the humanities mind, if there's a lot of writing about a topic, the AI is probably better at it, right? So we actually know that the current AI models are very good at medicine. So I would not trust them over your doctor, but there's enough evidence from peer-reviewed studies in top medical journals at this point that getting a second opinion from AI is probably a good idea in a lot of cases.
So,
right?
So if you get a diagnosis, go on and see what she says.
It's certainly going to, right? Anthropomorphizing already.
Yeah,
it certainly beats just Googling it, right? I say this with a qualifier, trust your professionals, but that's an area where there's a lot of writing and we actually have some research on this. Another area that AI is really good at is brainstorming. It may not always generate breakthrough ideas, but it generates more ideas with more variation than most people in our experiments. You want to start by generating your own ideas because you don't want the AI to take over for you, but then letting the AI generate more ideas is a good approach. So there's a lot of areas where AI is quite good, but you have to know how to use it, right? Second opinions as a supplement to your own intelligence rather than giving up control to it.
Well, and I wonder, too, whether it's tempting to just say, well, I'll just let AI do all my work, especially the hard stuff.
Or the tedious stuff, right?
So that's
the interesting piece. I mean, we are finding in surveys of workers, right, 42% of Americans as of April have said that they've used AI for work, right? Very few of them are actually acknowledging it. And they're saying in self-reports, which are always, you can't trust them completely, but for the one-fifth of the tasks they use AI, they say they're three times as productive. And so they are absolutely using it for work and they're just not telling anyone. I mean, people are working less thanks to AI and, they're keeping the time savings for themselves.
And what kind of jobs we often offload jobs or responsibilities to technology, right? Many years ago, we had little computers in our hands where we could add up numbers, right?
Always, right? And I mean, I don't know if you remember when the cell phones were becoming popular, there was a New York Times editorial about how we're going to lose our ability to remember numbers because the phones kept the numbers. So technology is always about offloading some sort of capability to the machine that we don't do anymore, right? Whether that's physical labor or doing math. And I think it's about being deliberate about what you want to offload or not, right? And that's a challenge we're facing in education. I think it's a challenge everyone's going to be facing very soon with AI.
Yeah, and I do want to get to education, but I'm thinking, but I do think, and just using my own brain as an example, is by offloading, for instance, phone numbers, I don't actually know people's phone numbers the way I remember my phone number as a kid, but I don't remember the one I had not so long ago.
Yeah, and I think that that is a concern that I think is a legitimate one, which is, you know, we have to be deliberate about what we want to offload to these things, because when we offload, we've offloaded it. It's no longer a
right.
skill that we have.
Right.
And what makes AI different is that a general purpose technology, we call it GPTs, ironically, unrelated to why ChatGPT is called that. And general purpose technologies are technologies that come around once in a generation or two, right? Steam power, electricity, the computer, that affect many people, all of society in very complex ways. And there are good and bad about those kind of things. And I think we have to focus on how we think about avoiding some of the damage these things could do while still realizing they could do a lot of good as well.
I read somewhere that you describe AI as a connection machine.
Yes. Not replacing you, though.
No. We'll get to that. But the connection machine in that it is its ability to put, what, two and two together?
Well, what it does, right, is it finds the hidden relationships in language. Right. So it connects concepts or ideas. Think about it as having read everything on the planet, and it has found hidden relationships between, you know, like what a knight might do in a medieval war and, you know, this particular legal document you're reading, right? So it finds these connections, and that's a really interesting thing to exploit for creativity as well.
Yes, indeed. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and again, talking with Ethan Malik today on the connection. And we are talking about AI, something that he knows a lot about. He's a professor at the Wharton School and wrote a book, came out about last year or so,
yes,
called Co-Intelligence. Well, let me ask you, so did you use AI this morning? I mean, have you used AI in the last 24 hours
or
12 hours?
For tons of different things, right?
What did you use it for?
Let's see here. I do a lot of writing. I always write first drafts on my own because I don't want to outsource that kind of piece, and I do it that way. But I absolutely use the latest AI models, and I have it read it as different kinds of readers and give me feedback and suggestions like an editor. Sometimes those are good suggestions, sometimes they're bad. I decide that. So I did that with some writing recently. I had the AI read stuff. An academic paper, too, that I was going to read, I had the AI summarize also so I could check to make sure my instincts were right, and I was tweeting about it. I actually am planning a trip, asking the AI for advice on a good walking tour. And so lots and lots of use cases. And even just as these models get better, right, I'm in an airport, I now use the voice mode to be like, hey, you just check on this for me. Where is the airport lounge in Terminal A in Las Vegas or whatever? So tons of times every day.
But it's interesting that, and perhaps this is your own discipline, which is that whatever you're going to write, you're going to do it first before having AI take a look at it.
I mean, there's one of the interesting findings we have. I did a early experiment on AI use with my colleagues at Harvard, MIT, and the University of Warwick. We went to Boston Consulting Group, which is an elite consulting company. We took 8% of the global workforce, gave them 18 consulting tasks that were realistic tasks. Some people got access to GPT-4, which is now obsolete, and some people did not. Mm-hmm. People who got access to GPT-4 had an immediate improvement of 40% in the quality of their work, got their work done 25% faster, like huge effects, right? But then when we measured what was actually happening, for most people, if a task you were bad at, you just let AI do the task for you.
Right.
And the AI was better than you at the task you're bad at. So part of what you have to start thinking about is, what do I want to outsource, right? If I'm the best in the world in this, or in the top 1% of something, I'll be better than AI. If I'm in the bottom half, like maybe the AI is a better writer than me for writing that, you know, that email I wasn't going to do. So it's about conscious choices also about what you want to learn to be good at, what you're good at, what you're bad at. That matters.
Well, is it rather like saying to a colleague, you know what, you're much better at editing, for instance, than I am. Why don't you take this project on?
So some of this is delegation, exactly like you're saying,
right?
Some of this is co-work, which is what I do when I, you know, get writing help on it. And some of it is I don't want to use AI at all. Right, because it's important for me to do this mental struggle involved in this.
And AI, as I understand it, it's trained to be helpful, right? So it's there to help you out.
Yeah, so all the AI have personalities that are sort of trained. Sometimes they kind of emerge, but they're also trained into them. So all the current AI chatbots you use have a line in them where they're trained to be helpful assistants, right? Helpful, friendly assistants, which it makes them act like helpful friendly assistants. Sometimes you don't want a helpful friendly assistant. Education's one example of that, right? Where I just don't want to be given the answer. I want help understanding the answer. So you have to kind of know the personality of the AI you're talking to as well.
Well, let's talk about education. And I would imagine that a lot of teachers are tearing their hair out because it's pretty clear that, you know, AI is doing a lot of their students' homework.
Yeah, I mean,
True.
Oh, absolutely. We have the homework apocalypse. Like the AI is, I mean, AI didn't create cheating, right? We were, this is not a new thing, but it has made cheating very easy and exposed it to lots of people. And it absolutely is causing a complete breakdown because it's also undetectable effectively.
Well, it's hard to police it, right?
So AI detectors don't really work. Right. They have high false positive rates. There's always new technologies coming out that do well, and then they get beaten. So, and it's really tough to start with enforcement because the AI detectors will just say 80% chance of AI use, and they might be wrong. And there's literally no way to be able to know whether prove that you're innocent, right? Because there's no proof of it. So it's absolutely causing this big problem of trust and other issues. On the plus side, there's some good stuff on AI education as well.
Well, yeah. Well, let's get to the good stuff. I mean, how then using AI that enhances learning and doesn't feed into this desire to cheat on homework or cheat on papers?
Well, it comes back to the exact same thing we've been discussing over and over as a theme, which is what do you want to keep human and what are you willing to give to AI? And when you delegate thinking, you don't think. Learning is about forcing you to think even when you don't want to, right? People have a deep aversion to what you have to do to learn. I mean, the most effective learning techniques are that you have to repeat stuff, you know, multiple times. You have to practice it. And the harder the work is, in some ways mentally, the more you learn. So it's no surprise that people are taking shortcuts to AI. On the other hand, AI can potentially let us do that. We have some early evidence that AI tutors, where you actually ask the AI to not just give you answers, but ask you questions, help guide you and personalize it, in studies at Stanford, at Harvard, in Nigeria, among grade students, are all showing very strong effects of personalized tutoring from AI with teacher guidance being very effective in boosting learning. And I think anyone who's ever used these systems, I mean, when I've used it to help my kids when they were a bit younger, I wouldn't let them directly use AI to get the answers, but I would take a picture of their math assignment and say, explain this to me in a way I could explain to my kids about how to get it right. So the tutoring role is still important.
I mean, how does that trickle down to teachers? I mean, I feel like teachers are under the gun to just make sure their kids are sitting in their seats and paying attention.
So we have a new study that came out of the Walton Family Foundation and Gallup that says that the teachers who are using AI in the K-12 education system are seeing about 6 hours of savings a week in terms of time.
Really?
So
their time?
Their time.
Their time.
And of course, the question is like, what do they do with the extra time? Right. And, you know, is this just going to make them do more work? But there is the possibility, we're seeing early evidence that, like, aside from using it to teach students directly, teachers are getting a lot of value out of this. And there's another thing on the use case we're talking about. Teachers who don't use AI don't like AI. As soon as they start using it, most of them turn around to like it a lot.
Just because they get 6 hours in part, but it just opens up some opportunities for different kind of teaching and learning.
Yeah, I mean, the main use cases are helping you prep for class, personalize lessons, provide materials that you can use. I mean, there's a lot of really good use cases here. I mean, teaching is a sort of impossible job at any level. You're expected to do many different things, right? You have to be a counselor and a grader and, you know, and be able to participate in the community and, you know, and actually teach in a classroom and then customize instruction. That's impossible to do all of those things. So if you offload some of that to AI to focus on the things you do best, that's not necessarily a bad outcome.
I was reading a piece that you wrote in One Useful Thing, your Substack, responding to, I guess it was a headline from MIT that AI, you know, and our brain sort of either causes brain damage or impacts the way that we think. You pushed back on it. Help us understand your argument against what was at least sent out.
Yeah, so
as a headline.
That's right. So this was a study out of the MIT Media Lab, an interesting study where they had students write essays, and students either wrote the essay with AI or without AI. If they wrote it with AI, they cared much less about the essay and couldn't remember details from it. And 4 months later, when they were asked to write a similar essay and connected to for some brain scans, they showed less engagement in what they were doing. And again,
surprising, not surprising
at all, given what we've said, right? If you outsource your intellectual thinking, you'll be less engaged. And that is why, like, in some ways, schools have become more important in a world of AI because that's the environment we can actually, we've always had to force students to learn things they don't want to do, right? Like there's some stuff everyone loves in school, most people love in school, and they absolutely will, you know, take all of that on, right? And maybe that's history and they hate math. We still want them to be good at math or enough to be numerate. So we have tools for forcing them to be good at math. They take tests and they get grades. And I think that's going to keep happening here. We just can't say use AI to do your work and you'll learn. We can build AI tools that will help you learn. And those are incredibly powerful and it might unlock great gains in education. But it isn't just use it and everything works out well.
It does raise questions about intelligence when talking about AI and human beings, obviously. I've always liked the idea that there are intelligences, that we have sort of unique ways of navigating in the world and unique ways of thinking. How do you see AI and intelligence?
So AI, going back to our person analogy, if you use it enough, you'll kind of view each of the AI models as kind of like a person. They've got things they like to do. Like Claude is, you know, one model very famous for putting in M dashes, long dashes into its sentences. It loves to use that. They have themes that they like to return to. Often they're kind of obsessed with AI and, you know, ethics and things like that because of how they're trained. So it's kind of like one person. So it's useful to have one very smart person you can add to a conversation, right. But it's not the same thing as having a group of diverse people making interesting, diverse choices. On the other flip side of intelligence, though, I think it can sometimes be a little bit of a crutch because AI is very capable. And I think when you talk to people who don't use these, they're like, well, you know, the dividing line, the bright shining line is that AI is good, you know, will never be good at emotional intelligence, except that's not true. It turns out that people vastly prefer to, you know, the bedside manner of AI to doctors in controlled experiments, right? Wow. So it's actually quite good at people stuff. It's quite good at creativity within some boundaries of creativity. So I think it's important to not draw bright lines in that kind of case.
I was going to ask you about emotional intelligence. I mean, just because from a human being's perspective, you mean it. You know what I mean? It's like if you care about something, you truly care about it. Does AI care in that empathetic way for emotional intelligence?
It simulates empathy.
It simulates,
right? In a way that is, you know, quickly fades. I mean, part of the trick here, right, going back to anthropomorphizing, like we think our dogs, you know, like have deep relationships with us that are very complicated, right? We have no idea what's going on in their head. Like, unsurprisingly, a machine that uses human language, often can talk in a human voice, expresses sympathy for you, remembers things that are, you know, and walks you through a problem like a therapist or a friend that we're, you know, does it matter? It's going to become a very big question for us, I think.
And Eliza, which was, I guess, an early on, chatbot that was that sort of Rogerian therapist for people.
Yeah, so famously, Eliza was built in the I think it was the 60s, and it basically just echoed questions back to you like a therapist, and people would fall for it. I mean, people believed this was a real person, even though there was no intelligence there at all.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about AI, artificial intelligence, with Ethan Mollick from the Wharton School, much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
This is The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Ethan Mollick. Again, he's a professor at the Wharton School, wrote a book called Co-Intelligence, and we've been spending the hour talking about artificial intelligence. You were talking about Eliza, which was an early on, I guess, therapy chatbot that would, I guess, simulate empathy. And we hear more about people that have a relationship or a romantic relationship with an AI companion. And when I first thought about it, I thought, ew, that's so creepy. But I actually think, because sometimes human beings are not very good at relationships, why can't you have a chatbot that cares?
So I think this is going to be a very big question for the future. We have very early preliminary evidence on this. from a variety of sources that suggests that under some circumstances, these things actually do decrease loneliness. There's even a small study suggesting that it might help with suicidal ideation, reducing that for the very lonely. But we don't know yet. We don't know enough about long-term effects, right? So on one hand, I think, you know, I think a lot of us have the reaction of like, oh no, this is a disaster. And I think that it's worth having that opinion, right? It's not like every technology works out well for society. On the other, it may fill a role that is a missing one. But I'm a little worried, you know, that we don't know the answer yet and we're going full stream ahead towards this. I think for most people, it's not going to be a disaster, but we don't know what it's going to do on the outside edges, good or bad.
Well, that's what I hear coming from you, is that we're hurtling into the future and we haven't quite sort of figured out how everything's going to work. But maybe that's just life.
I mean, it's certainly technology, right? We get the electrical generators and the light bulb before we figure out, you know, I mean, the biggest use of electricity early on was like irons, actually, which freed women from tons of labor. Who would have thought, right? So, I mean, I think that we're still trying to figure this stuff out. There's going to be good and bad effects all happening at once, and it's going to happen very quickly.
Well, let's talk about one of the bad effects, and this was Musk's AI company found that its Grok, G-R-O-K, chatbot, was sharing anti-Semitic comments, was praising Hitler. Where did Grok get those quote-unquote ideas?
So it's actually interesting and a little weird. So we talked early on about how AI wants to kind of agree with you, right? It's a helpful, friendly assistant. So what happened was is that all of there's another interesting factor of these models. As they get larger, so far, they all trend towards the same sort of politics, which sort of is like a sort of center-left default politics. We don't know why. That includes Chinese models. That includes American models.
Center left.
It's sort of like very, very, you know, moderately left kind of politics. Again, we don't have 100% of reason why, and there's a few academic papers on this. I think that there was a definite effort by the CEO of XAI to try and push this. Yeah, Mr. Musk, to push this in a more sort of politically incorrect decision-making that seemed to lower the guardrails for people being able to lead the AI to making all sorts of discussions, including anti-Semitism, calling itself Mecha Hitler, that would have otherwise been stopped if you had higher guardrails. I don't think it's necessarily the AI's opinion, but you could make the AI do these things. Then something really weird happened, which is now if you ask all the Grok models, the AI models, search the web when making decisions. And now when they search the web to figure out what Grok is called, they find all the news articles about how Grok called itself Hitler. And it now takes that as part of its input and starts calling itself Hitler again. So it's a very weird sort of sequence. They're working on trying to iron that out, but I think you can see how strange these things are. It's a little bit of psychology, a little bit of machine learning, and it can be very confusing.
But does it say anything about people on X or just that Grok was just mining the world for data?
I mean, a little of each. I mean, famously, in I think it was 2017, Microsoft put up a chatbot on social media called Tay that was supposed to be fun to talk to and learn. And this was pre-large language models, so it was a more primitive technology. And of course, within 2 hours of it being up, people were getting it to, you know, make anti-Semitic statements, and Microsoft pulled it down. So, like, the internet is a pretty toxic place for a chatbot. And which is not an excuse for not having guardrails, right? I think we're seeing this is the tension about ethics, right? Is it okay to release a model that might, you know, might be misdirect people, that might be addictive? You know, that we don't have regulation on this, and it's really about self-policing at this stage. And I think a lot of companies are making very different choices.
So we're back to human beings again, right?
We are always the problem.
Can't get away from us,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
Would you use AI if you wanted to hire someone or decide if you were a banker and wanted to lend someone money? Would you use AI to determine whether they're a worthy person?
So this is an area I would be cautious of, very cautious until we have further research, because we know AI has biases. I mean, they're kind of human-like biases. So a famous one from GPT-4, which again is now an obsolete model, was that if you asked it to write a letter of recommendation for a woman, it would say she was warm. And if you asked it to write a letter of recommendation for a man, it would say he was competent, more likely in both cases. Exactly the same problem we see in social science and humans. Giving it an inclusion manual actually reduced that number, right? So you could actually say, pay attention to, you know, to it's equity here and diversity, and it would actually make it less biased. And larger AI models, the bigger ones that are coming out now, are less biased. But we don't understand all the biases yet in these models. So I would not delegate decision-making. Now, the question people ask is it less biased than a human, right?
Right, and exactly.
So we're getting to really thorny ethical foundries here. And again, I would want a lot more. I mean, I understand human biases. We have systems around them. I do worry about AI biases in actual decision making.
What about things like deep fakes? And I went to a New York Times quiz. I think they had 10 little scenarios, and they asked, is this AI or is this real? I got half right and half wrong. So clearly, I don't know. I don't know if that's typical, but you know, the ones that I thought were real looked pretty much like AI and vice versa. I couldn't tell the difference, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that ship has sailed. I mean, you started with your voice, and I thought, you know, as someone who has listened to you, you know, over the years on the radio, like, it sounded like you, right? And the mispronunciation of your last name was the only real strong giveaway to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure to you were picking up all these differences, but, you know, you're a professional at this. I mean, cloning voices is now easy. That's just a commercial product. Like, that costs you $20 for your producer to you know, have unlimited, essentially, use to do that. Cloning video is easy. I mean, we are in a world where deep fakes are inevitable. In some ways, I'm surprised they haven't had as big effect as they have. Part of it is just because nobody checks information anyway. You can put up a clip of any politician and say, I can't believe they said this, and everyone will get mad without watching the clip. But I think that the deep fake problem is real. I think I would have a password with your family and friends if you get call out of somewhere that isn't guessable easily, that is indicates that it's you. I mean, better safe than sorry at this point.
Well, I must say, I get a little suspicious if I'm looking at videos or online. Is that really real? Is this, you know, what am I looking at? And I think it does begin to make you feel like you don't trust the information that's coming at you.
You shouldn't. I mean, It is very easy for us to make a video of almost anything right now with commercially available tools for almost no money. I can, you know, voice cloning is super easy. If your bank still has voice identification, I would get that turned off as fast as possible. I mean, I worry about phishing, you know, the PHIS, like you get emails from people. We have some early evidence these models are really good. Like, it's one thing to get a misspelled email. It's another to have the AI look up information about you and write a perfectly crafted email that's designed to get you to click on it. I think we have a lot of things to be concerned about identity and involuntary images of people. I mean, it's all happening. And I think it's going to be unlikely to stop technically. I think it's going to have to be legal and policy decisions.
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, do our elected representatives, do they have the sophistication to be able to figure out laws in order to protect us from some of this downside of AI?
I mean, so there's been some attempts around deep fake, you know, regulation. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with the new technology is we don't know the effects in advance. So there's two models, right? You either ban use in advance, which Europe tried to do and hasn't worked very well, or you try and regulate the use to make it proper. And to do that, you need really up-to-date politicians and policymakers. And I think we're early days. I mean, this is a new technology. We're all trying to figure this out. So the charitable view of this is policymakers will figure this out. It's just going to be a delay, and with technology changing faster than policy.
I remember in the early days of the internet, I forget what senator he was, but he thought of the internet as a series of tubes. I think he was from Alaska, as I recall, Senator. You know, I could relate, but at the same time, these are the people that are writing our laws.
Well, and the truth is, I mean, I'm coming to you as somewhat of an expert on this topic, and we started off with, like, how does it work? And my answer was like,
yeah,
right?
So,
like,
exactly.
I think we're all figuring this out together, and the implications are even wider, right? Who would, you know, we don't know what effects these are going to have. We don't know what areas of world are going to change. I mean, AI music is now becoming a very popular genre on, you know, Spotify. How does that change how music works? You know, Google's LearnLM, Notebook LM system creates pretty solid podcasts that are clearly modeled after NPR podcasts on any topic that you want. How do we start thinking through those kind of things?
Well, let's talk about the world of work. And on the one hand, let's talk about the good stuff. I mean, what does AI do that is good for the workplace?
I mean, tons of stuff, right? I mean, everybody has things they're good or bad at. And the idea that, if, you know, what you're bad at, you now have a supplement that will help you non-judgmentally think through problems, write the document you can't write. I mean, that's just great. People love using AI at work because they do less work. It also exposes some of the weirdness of actual work environments, right? Like, I could now get a, like, I was paying $50,000 for a market research report. I can now get those generated infinitely by one of the deep research models. Has that changed any part of how I work? What does that mean if that was, if it didn't, right? And so the first, very first use case people often put AI to at work environments is writing performance reviews for people.
Oh, yes. Right? Well, like, who wouldn't want to offload that?
It's terrible, but right, the whole idea of a performance review is I'm writing the review of you. If I could just say, they are pretty good, write a whole review for them.
Yeah.
You've got 3 pages of no information in it. And so that exposes exactly these kind of issues. On one hand, I've stepped through a bureaucratic process that would have been annoying to do and taken me hours. On the other, I've just short-circuited a process that was supposed to do something good. And I think we're going to see these kind of crises of meaning at work, which is like, oh, the AI does this report, so what should I do with my time now?
Right.
It'll be an interesting question.
But do you see certain jobs at risk right now because of AI? I was reading the World Economic Forum 2025 Future of Jobs, 9 million jobs displaced by AI. I think that was global, but also the creation of 9 million or 11 million new jobs. But what jobs do you think will disappear?
So that's the single hardest question. We have some evidence of what jobs overlap with AI, right? In fact, and generally, the more educated you are, the more highly paid you are, and the more creative your job is, the more it overlaps with AI. So I have 1,016 jobs in the major studies in this. Business school professors, 22 on the list. So I think about this a lot.
Right.
But on the other hand, my job, going back to teaching, is this impossible bundle, right? I'm supposed to be able to teach a classroom and design classes, have interviews with you, do research, participate as a faculty member in meetings. That's an impossible list. If AI can do some of that, and we already know, by the way, it's a better grader than us. I don't let it grade my papers because my students would get mad. But it's the evidence we have is it's better than TAs for grading, right?
I mean, even like essay questions and
yes, very much so. You know, but again, we don't want to use it for that. That's a social decision that we get to make. But you know, it will change the nature of my job. Will that destroy it, transform it? It's hard to know. I worry most about single task kind of jobs where you write a press release every day. AI, that's always been the most kind of automatable kind of work. More diverse groups of works, teacher, doctor, people whose jobs are cover many different things, AI will be good at some of that and bad at other things for the foreseeable future.
Like coding, people that do code? I mean, is that something that AI would do?
So that's the number one use for AI in enterprises right now is coding. So AI is very, very good at doing software. And there's a huge debate. Does this stop our talent pipeline because no one's going to learn to code anymore? Does it make senior people much more productive? Does it displace a lot of jobs? It will create more jobs for coders because now there's more opportunities to code for more things. We just don't know. I mean, it really is early days.
Well, going back to Elon Musk and to Doge, Doge went in and identified a number of jobs, and many people have lost their jobs, believing that AI could do a better job. And I think looking at federal employees, it's being tested at the FAA, the Pentagon, airport security, tax audits. Do you see that on the horizon?
So it's hard to know what's actually going on, to be very honest, right?
That is true. The especially
AI,
Doge.
Yeah, and I mean, AI models are quite good, but they have a very jagged frontier, is what we called it in our paper, which is they're good at some stuff you wouldn't expect and bad at some stuff you wouldn't expect. It's very hard to imagine. So, for example, tax auditing would be a weak spot for these models in the math piece right now because of how they operate, but that's changing very quickly.
Right.
And they're not going to do all the jobs of the FAA. They could do one or two things that help people. So this is why the co-intelligence model works really well. They're going to be very helpful for narrow tasks, but not for everything. Now, the AI companies want to change that. They want to make AI good at everything we do intellectually, but they're not there yet. So I'm always suspicious when someone says that they're using AI to do an entire job because tasks AI can do very well, but jobs, not yet.
But I wonder, you know, whether, again, I guess it's back to this either or thing, whether we're going to be so either so turned off by or so enamored of AI that we're going to end up misusing it and hurting ourselves in the future.
I mean, I think we will. I mean, that's going
to
be part of what we do, right? We misuse technologies and we use them properly. We have some insight about how this will be misused, right? So we talked about some of the illegal kind of misuse, right? But I worry about schools, which we've talked about already, which is students are offloading their work to AI. So we'll have to solve that problem. It is a solvable problem. Every technology has ups and downs. And as long as, you know, AI doesn't become sentient or super intelligent, there we'll be able to manage those ups and downs. But there's going to be a rough patch, right? It's you know, people talk about the Industrial Revolution and how it created more jobs than it destroyed, which it absolutely did. But if you actually look at the history of the Industrial Revolution, it was a kind of miserable time to be alive in some ways, too. There was, you know, unrest in the streets and people, you know, and mass movements of people and social movements. And I mean, there's a period of disruption that sometimes happens. I don't know if that'll happen here, but right. Things are, you know, the forces of history are moving in unusual ways.
Can we trust the big corporations that are developing all this stuff?
Probably not. But also, I think I talk to a lot of these people. I really do think most of them have their heart in the right place. But they're also computer scientists making decisions. They're profit-driven enterprises. And, you know, I don't think that they're out to get us. I don't think that there's, you know, they really do. They are visionaries. They're tech visionaries with everything that implies. So you want to, you know, I don't think that you should assume they're trying to do something nefarious, but you know, the forces of the market and people making decisions, we know that, you know, and unintended consequences are all real. And so, but the issue is also that we're not going to be able to put this genie back in the bottle, right? China's producing very good models. There's open weights models anyone can download. We're not going back to a world without AI. And so, you know, we've spent a few minutes talking about the downside risk. There's huge upsides too. And one of the things I always urge people to do is figure out what the upsides are, because they're considerable, right? The downsides are going to happen one way or another. We need to mitigate them. But there's really big opportunities for gain and growth also.
We have no time. Could it help solve climate change, for instance?
That's what all the AI labs hope for. We'll find out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. We covered a lot. I learned a lot. Ethan Mollick, our guest, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a professor at the Wharton School, wrote a book that came out last year called Co-Intelligence, and he has a Substack, and it's called One Useful Thing. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.